Eric Weisberg, who was on this program in May of last year, if you missed his interview, which was over an hour, one of the longest ones we've ever done, but Eric was a very influential musician, banjo player during the folk period in New York area, and through that as a studio musician, all types of string instruments, and most famously for the Deliverance album, what was come to be called the Deliverance album. But in that interview, Eric talked about at a very young grade school age, he met and became kind of a student of Pete Seeger and maintained that relationship with Pete, and talked to Eric yesterday and asked, given the events of this week, if he would be interested in coming on and sharing some of his memories and stories about Pete Seeger. So we're going to do that. No idea how many stories he has, but I know that Eric has great affection for Pete, as everybody who's ever touched a banjo. You know, Pete Seeger was the first banjo teacher that a lot of people were exposed to, probably wrote the very first book. Eric was actually involved in that process as a child, as I think Pete was attempting to get some feedback on how to best produce the music so that it could be more accessible by children and just players in general. Pete Seeger passed away this week at the age of 94. It's hard to believe he was that old. It's hard to believe that he's not going to be around. Pete was always around. Pete Seeger was, all my opinion here, the never-tiring musical conscience of American people. He had that quality of playing music that was from his heart, but was also instantly meant to grab everybody in. A mass participation was a big thing for Pete. If you ever saw him on TV, or saw him, if you were lucky enough to know him, if you saw him live, I never did. Everybody had to sing. That's the way Pete Seeger was. It was mass participation, always for the enjoyment of music and always for the principles of justice and freedom, really, as Pete saw him, forever, never ended. There was never a day that I knew of, that I heard of, when you couldn't count on Pete to be still there for protecting individuals, whatever he believed their rights should be, and with as much heart and energy as he had, Pete Seeger never gave up. I always felt, as long as Pete was out there, that any moment that you felt downtrodden, that you were never alone. And now that he's gone, we all have to kind of pick up the pieces and provide that same support, just so that we know that if we're in that position, that someone's out there sort of looking out and saying, look, let's get together and sing and look at these issues. So Pete Seeger, amazing, amazing person in this country's musical history, political history too, like it, agree or not, doesn't really matter at this point. His impact was so pervasive. And I think we have on the phone right now Mr. Eric Weisberg. Are you still there, Eric?
I am.
Okay. I might ask you just to let me turn my sound up a little bit in my headphones. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Turn it up a little for me too.
Turn it up for you. Can you hear me on the phone?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
All right. Eric, you were on this show back in May of 2013, and we talked about all of the influence that you've had and received up in New York, and all the music that you played throughout the folk scene, and how you transitioned into a lot of studio work. And of course, everybody's familiar with your great five-string banjo playing. And in that conversation, we talked a little bit about your initial contact with Pete Seeger. And I wondered if maybe, and I asked you yesterday to come on, and maybe we can talk about that some more in light of the sad events this week of Pete Seeger passing on.
Yeah, it's that was a very rough day for me. I was I was numb all day, you know, because we go so far back, and I have a feeling. I can't imagine that there's another banjo player out there who's still playing and this and that, who goes back further than I do with Pete, because I think it was 1944. My parents sent me away to sleepaway camp up here in Phoenicia, called Camp Woodland. Became fairly famous. And I was four then. I was in junior camp, a little tiny little thing. But Pete used to come to the camp once each month and sing for us, but mainly get the kids to sing, get everybody to sing. That was his big thing. Everybody sang, you know. And so I was one of those little tiny kids. And then in the winter time, I was born and raised on the Lower East Side, and then my parents sent me to elementary school at the Little Red Schoolhouse on Bleecker Street. And Pete used to come there in the winters and do the same thing, basically, all the kids do. So I got a double dose of Pete when I was really small.
Hmm.
And it was very significant to my whole life. But also, my parents were progressive and this kind of thing. And they took me to, when the Weavers were forming, I was going to those concerts with them, or a little bit later without them. And I was listening to all those people when I was about six, I would say, something like that. Pete decided that, and I came up with a good idea, to have a little, what he called a wingding in his apartment, his house on McDougal Street in the Village. And this was for the little kids only. And this was Saturday mornings for about an hour and a half or something like that, whatever. And we would go there, and he would do the same thing, get us to sing and sing for us and teach us some songs and stuff like that. And every once in a while, he had his friends, and he would convince them to come and sing and get in on the thing that was happening in his apartment and sing for the kids. And who were those friends? Those friends were Woody Guthrie, Lead Belly, Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, Cisco Houston, people like that.
Wow.
And there were others too. And so I was exposed to this kind of music at a really young age. And it just, took over with me. And then in school, in Little Red Schoolhouse, at some point, somebody handed me a banjo in music class. And they showed me some chords. It was our music teacher. And she showed me some chords and this and that. And I kind of started noodling along on the banjo when I was like six. And then, I was doing that in the winters. And then when I went to the camp, I brought my banjo with me, and I was playing, and I could sort of play reasonably well. Then Pete's dad came up with the idea. He said, "Pete, why don't you write a banjo instruction manual book?" He said, "Because there aren't any." And Pete thought it was a really good idea, and he started preparing for that, and started doing it. I was about eight then, and in the same place, the same house on McDougal Street. And so there was, I would say maybe 10 people, most of them young adults, and a lot older than I was. But and so he would give us some sort of a technique on one day, and then we would have a week off, and we would go home and practice it and come back, and he would check us out and see if we were doing it right and help us out and stuff like that. And give us another technique to learn. But he's told me, here's the thing about talking about Pete.
Sure.
Everybody knows about Pete. So when I talk about Pete, it's hard for me because I'm not really talking about Pete exactly. I'm talking about myself. But I don't know any other way of talking about Pete without doing that.
Eric, this is your connection with Pete, so you have to be in the story. I you mentioned this the other day too, and I said, "Listen, man, that's just the way. That's what we want to hear."
Yeah, I know. I still feel kind of guilty.
No.
I mean, but like you say, that's the way it was. And I mean, he told me, later, you know, he said, "Eric, I was 1 week ahead of you." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, I would give the class a new technique thing, and you would come back in a week, and you could play it better than I could play it." And and he's put that in print also. I don't know how true it is, but I was reasonably good. You know, I became pretty good, and then there was no bluegrass then. He was not teaching us. There was nothing like it. The nearest thing was double thumbing, and there is a relationship between double thumbing and bluegrass picking, like Earl does. So a couple of years later, that bluegrass started coming up north, and I heard it, and I just freaked out. Actually, it was in Elizabeth Irwin High School. I was a couple of years behind Mary Travers. She went there too. Mm-hmm. We used to sing together and stuff like that. That's the kind of things that we were doing. And then I discovered, I was doing a thing for the school assembly one day. It was Thanksgiving, and they were doing some sort of little Americana pageant, and they had me playing fiddle, a friend of mine, Mickey, playing guitar, and behind me on the stage on a slight riser was a guy named Mike Steig, who was playing the banjo. And I knew Mike, and he was right, the banjo head was it was right behind my head, right at ear level. He was staying on this riser, and he wasn't strumming like Pete did. He was doing something else. He was playing individual notes, and it was all I could do not to, you know, pee in my pants, because I'd never heard anything like that, really. And at the end of the square dance, I turned around and I said, "You have to show me that." And of course, he knew that I played the banjo, and he said, but he never would. He totally refused to show me anything.
Really?
It was really strange. But his girlfriend at the time also went to school there, and you know, he was showing her very rudimentary thing, and she knew my plight, and she said, "I'll show you what he showed me," and she showed me a very rudimentary thumb 1-2 kind of thing. And that got me going, and told me where there was a record store on 14th Street, not far from the school, where they had bluegrass records. And she said, go in there and look for the bin that says Earl Scruggs, Flatten Scruggs, and see what they had this in. So I went there, and they had a preview room where you could put the record on and see if you liked it or not. And so I did that, and I bought a couple of records, and I put them on my dad's variable speed turntable at home in our apartment. And I could slow the things down. It was astounding. And I could teach myself sort of what Earl was doing. And that's really how the whole thing started with the bluegrass for me. And, of course, I still played the other styles and stuff, but the bluegrass thing really took over. And it took over with a lot of people. I mean, you know, it came up north, and I was definitely one of the first people playing it in New York City. There was Roger Sprung and a guy named Willie Dykeman from New Jersey, and they were doing it also. I did meet them. And they showed me a lot of things, were extremely helpful, and I'm very thankful to them for being like that and not hiding anything. And it progressed into hooking up with John Harold, which is another very, really long story, but incredible, about the University of Wisconsin, where we discovered each other. And then we played, and while we went to Washington Square, and I had been doing this for years, from Washington Square every Sunday in the summertime, and we would play with other people and listen to other people and this and that. And we, John Harold and I, got hooked up with Bob Yellen, and we formed the Greenbrier Boys, which I believe was one of the very first, certainly the first real bluegrass band in New York City. There was some up north, but it was just really starting to come in and get popular, and people were freaking out about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what I continued with. But, you know, Pete was always, you know, intertwined in my life and stuff, and played with the Weavers and at Carnegie Hall and things like that. So our lives were really intertwined. And I'm so thankful for it, because there's nobody ever going to be like Pete. There's never been anybody like Pete before. And
he never wavered. He never got off course. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was always, it seemed to me, and I never met him, never had the pleasure, but he was always Pete Seeger. He was always that same guy that was teaching those young kids, let's sing, let's learn a song. He was always true.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And it's so important that he was like that, because he brought so much to the table and absorbed a lot from the table, you know, on his trips down south and all that stuff. I was watching last night, they had on the PBS, The Power of Song, the movie about him, where I have a little 15-second thing. And, you know, it was really, really nice to see it again. And I remember seeing him, you know, watching him do his thing.
So, and if people are just now tuning in, we're talking to Eric Weisberg, and Eric was there in that whole New York folk scene as it kind of converted into and merged with what was in the burgeoning, I guess, bluegrass feel that hit the same period. And we were talking about Pete Seeger and Eric's contact with him as a very young child. And you mentioned this book. Did you ever, of course, I don't think you needed the book, but did you ever see the results of that little class you were attending where he was trying to keep one week ahead of you? Did you ever see the book?
Yeah, I did see the results of it. And, of course, it's a great book, because he was very scholarly. Dad was a scholar. And, I mean, he knew how to do this. You know, that kind of thing. I just had something go in my brain and come right out again. So I'm trying to gather it back. But, like I say, it was a tough day that day. And I've been saying for a long time, since Pete's 90th birthday party, which he invited me to be a part of in Madison Square Garden. Not all that many people have a birthday party in Madison Square Garden, but it was packed to the gills, and a fantastic night and day preparing for it, and it was just a fantastic show. And I think about somewhere around that time, I started saying to myself, this world, as bad as it is now, and I think it's horrendous now in a lot of ways, I said, this is going to be a much worse place when Pete's not here. And I hope doesn't really come true, but I don't see how it cannot, at least for a while, because he brought so much to the table and to the world. Where else to go with this right now?
Well, it's really hard, Eric. Let me suggest, it's really hard to put into words, because you knew him from a very early age, but there was always kind of this feeling that, you know, Pete was always gonna, nobody ever thinks you're gonna stay forever, but Pete Seeger was always there, and he was always teaching and getting people to sing. And he was always standing up for those things he believed in, always. And I mean, it never ended. So he was always like the touchstone for all of us to say, well, okay, let's see what Pete's got to say about this issue, or how. And his approach was always the same. You know, let's sing, let's join together, let's unite, and let's find a way to make peace over whatever issue he was talking about.
Right. I haven't paid much attention to the communist thing, although I did watch the hearings on TV when they were on a little tiny TV set with about a 3-inch screen that they were back then. And I remember it, but it didn't really affect me at all. I was too young to be, I think, going that way with politics. I wasn't very political, and I still not really all that political, but I do have ideas about the way the world is going now, so which is not all that good.
Well, I mean, for the listeners, what you're talking about is Pete was actually blacklisted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I remember watching the hearings. I mean, it was horrible, with some friends and who were also in our class at Little Red Schoolhouse and stuff, and we were all horrified. We were horrified on both sides because we didn't really care that Pete was like that. It was, all we cared really was about the music, and I cared about the instrument. And but you know, in the end, it sort of became okay. I mean, it worked out, you know. And he continued his amazing life.
Well, you know this, he never changed. I mean, even after that devastating, you know, when someone's on national TV in the 50s and they put that shroud of being blacklisted, it didn't change what he did.
No, it didn't. It didn't. And in a way, it made the Weavers something stronger, I think. I'm still very close friends with the remaining Weavers. As a matter of fact, yesterday I talked with Fred Hellman for about 2 hours on the phone. Mm. And a little bit with Ronnie. She's out in California. And she still is singing. And she was, back then, I mean, her voice and the way she sang was so intense and so fantastic. It's impossible to separate, you know, yourself from that sound. Her sound, it was so strong, and Pete was really strong, too. They were all strong. But Ronnie was just fantastic. She's still singing.
Eric, go ahead.
Yeah.
We were talking just yesterday, and you mentioned something about, and I asked if it was too soon to do this. I didn't want to put you in a spot, and I know it's a very emotional thing for you because of the relationship you have with Pete. And you mentioned something about, you know, Pete standing in your house, and I wasn't quite sure what that was, but yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, this is one of the most amazing things. I mean, for me, because of my relationship. When I was getting very busy in the studios in New York, and I needed some place to go on the weekends to get away. And I said, well, let me start looking in the Catskills and see if I could find something. By that time, I was friends with Bill Keith, and I called up and I said, let me come to see your house again. And so we got together, and he's got a great house, and he's only like half a mile from me. You know, we go back half a century too, maybe even more.
You're talking about Bill?
And yeah, Bill Keith, mm-hmm. One of the greatest banjo players of all time, obviously. And I fell in love with his house, and I said, you know, I'm going to start looking around here. And he gave me the name, I think, of a real estate agent, and I started looking with her. And I looked for around 2 years, and I couldn't really find anything that really, really made me say, yeah, this is the one. And then finally the agent said, well, Eric, that's all I have to show you in your kind of meager, the price range. And she said, well, I have one more, but it's like almost double what, you know. I said, well, let me see it anyway. And we came over here on Boggs Hill in Woodstock, and it was this house here, and we looked at it, and I said, gee, this is really, I really like this. It was 100-year-old house, and we made a deal, and I got a pretty nice deal with 8 or 9 acres or whatever, and started coming up here on weekends. And my very next door neighbor, right, our property lines, one on top of the other almost. We're right together. And they knew that I was a banjo player. They knew me from the folk days and everything. And one of them said to me one day, she said, you know, Pete Siegel used to live in there. I said, wait a minute, come on, don't fool around with my head, you know, like that. I said, what do you mean? She says, no, I'm not kidding. And here's the story. This camp, Camp Woodland, that I went to for so long, from age 4 to 13, where Pete used to come twice a summer, the caretakers of the camp was a guy named Takashi Ota. He's an older guy, middle-aged guy. And also his young son, who was probably about maybe 12 or 13, maybe something like that. And they worked together, and they took care of things that needed to be done around the property, building little buildings and stuff like that, whatever. And so everybody knew them. And, of course, like I say, I went there for several years. And so everybody knew them. And what it was, Takashi, the dad, came over here from Japan in the late 30s and emigrated here, and somehow came to Woodstock, found this house, and started living in it with his wife. And so, let me see, I'm trying to get my train of thought together. I know what it was. So I found myself at the airport going to Europe with the Blue Velvet Band, with Bill Keith and Jim Rooney and stuff. We were going to do in Denmark a huge folk festival. And so we were in the airport waiting for them to board the plane, and there's Pete and Toshi in the airport. They were on the thing, too.
And Toshi is Pete's wife?
Yeah, Toshi was Pete's wife.
Okay.
And so I said, hey, Pete, you know, somebody just told me, my next-door neighbor told me that my house in Woodstock that I go back and forth with and live in, that you used to live in there. And he said, well, I remember a little stream right next to the house. And 10 feet from the house is a little stream that doesn't even run all the time. It's a runoff stream. I said, well, there's a little stream right there. And he mentioned something else. And I said, yeah, I have that, you know. And so I started looking more into it. And it turns out it was true. And one summer at the camp, my mom took a job in the office of the camp. They were doing office work and paperwork and stuff like that. Also working in this, doing the same thing, was a young Toshi. And they became really good friends. And so I told Pete about it. All of a sudden, one day, my mom is here. And I was out playing golf or something. I came back, and she said, you'll never guess who came in the driveway while you were gone. I said, well, tell me then. She said, Toshi Seeger. And they had a huge reunion. I mean, it was incredible. You know, she told me about it. And she said it was wonderful, you know. And anyway, and the whole family then. And then one day I was in the house, and a car drove in that I didn't recognize, and I went outside to see who it was and walked up to the parking zone that I have. And as I was walking up there, one person got out of one side, and a young guy, and the other person got out from behind the wheel, an older guy, and they started walking towards me as I was walking up the hill, looking at the house, and I said to myself, wait a second. And I said to the older guy, "Did you work at Camp Woodland?" And he just freaked out. He said, "How would you know that?" I said, "Because I went to Camp Woodland, and it was the son, grown up, who was, you know, the young son who was a caretaker, with his son getting out the other side of the car. And so he said, how did you know? I said, well, I went there for like 8 or 9 years. And so we had a reunion, a hugging thing. I mean, because it was very emotional, even though we really didn't know each other back then, you know. But and he came in the house and he said, yeah, this is it. This is definitely the house. And then one day Toshi came also. And my mom was here and they had a reunion. I mean, so it's definitely, I mean, how bizarre is it that after looking for a couple of years for a house, I would wind up with a house that Pete Seeger, one of the most important people in my whole life, would have lived in.
It's one of those ironies of life, Eric, you know, just one of those ironies. Listen, I know that this has been a very difficult week, and I appreciate you being available, and I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but and you've already mentioned his importance to your music and just to the everything in general, but do you have any other comments you want to make about Pete Seeger, his influence on in music in general, in the country, and your playing, and just what he meant to you as a friend?
Yeah, and like I said, it was a numbing day. And I had a thing from Judy Collins sent me something. She said about how she was there in the hospital, and he was in her arms the moment that he died, actually. And so she wrote something up about it. She's very eloquent with writing and in all ways. And so that's a pretty nice thing. So, you know, the group of the folkies from back then is still fairly close-knit, you know. We still talk to each other. We're still interested in what the other is doing. And I'm still happy to be playing when I can play, you know. I'm still really good friends with Bill Keith. We see each other all the time. And, you know, our banjo playing goes way back together. And Bill has a relationship with Peter also. And, you know, here we are together. And it's a nice thing to be in this place. Kind of right now,
yeah.
Where I want to be, yeah.
Yeah, you've been through it all and experienced it all and at a high level on your own side. It's not like you were just a someone looking in. You were participating through the whole thing and met all these great people and this wonderful experience.
Yeah.
And you had a unique relationship with Pete Seeger, and just congratulations, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, if there's anybody out there who has a longer relationship, a banjo player who has a longer relationship with Pete, I would love to know about it and talk with them and stuff.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to me, it meant, I want to say everything. It meant everything because it led me into a way of life.
Wow.
Picking on the banjo like Pete did.
Eric Weisberg, thanks so much, man, for being available on a short notice. And we'll talk again sometime, anytime you want. We'll catch up where we left off, okay?
Okay, man.
Hey, thanks, Eric.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to tell the story.
Good.
It eases the pain a little bit, I have to admit, you know.
Good. I'm glad.
But
I'm glad.
It'll be around for a while. So.
Oh, sure. All right.
Okay, man. Thanks again.
Eric, we'll talk later, dude.
Okay,
all
thanks,
right, bye.
Man. Bye.
There you go, Eric Weiss. Felt at some point you don't want to intrude. It was very nice of Eric to be available. You could tell he was having difficult times just really remembering all of the points about Pete because it's so emotional. It's so new, and it's like, you know, where do you go? Do you not give him the opportunity? I was glad at the end he said he was glad he had the opportunity to talk about it a little bit because it was helpful for him. So there, Eric Weisberg on the show on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass, and thanks so much, everybody, that made that possible, and you all know who you are, And Eric, thanks for sharing those very personal moments. And I always want to remind the listeners also that unless I tell you, everything that you hear on this program is live. There's no editing. You can listen to the interviews later on the website, unrealbluegrass.com. But I hope that you appreciate the fact that the people that appear on this show put themselves on the line in the sense that they're live. And then, of course, Eric Weisberg generously offered maybe too soon. I think the last comment was helpful in that he said this helped him. to come on in the same week that he lost someone that he's known since he was 4 years old, and Pete Seeger, which is a devastating loss to music and musicians everywhere, I think. And I appreciate so much the willingness of those people to come on live. We don't do this and edit it. We don't come back and put in commercials. We're talking as it happens.